You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, September 18th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. You know what that means. On the program today, Cliff Schechter talking about the week in politics, the week that will be in politics. And, of course, more on the Republican debate. You're not tired of it, are you? I'm not. Also joining us to ostensibly recommend a streaming movie over the weekend, Film Guy Matthew. We'll also be featuring a song from Jimmy Reefer Cake. You're going to have to vote during the course of this show as to which one you hear on the free show. Also on the program today, on the verge of another potential government shutdown, Republican leadership begging its insane caucus, don't do this to us. Still may happen. Meanwhile, Republican attempts to derail the Iran deal in the Senate fail yesterday. Tried to push an amendment. It said something jibber-jabber about Israel and something else. Democrats held strong. Kim Davis inspiring bigots across the country. And a Catholic congressman says, I'm boycotting the papal visit to Washington because he's going to talk about climate change. And lastly, a Rand Paul advisor claims that a Rubio aide punched him in the face. Matt was wondering what I was laughing at before the program. And that's what I was laughing at. All that and more on today's program. Hey, folks, congratulations. This summer, the hottest summer on record. Now, of course, it's very un-Catholic of me apparently to say so, according to this congressman from Arizona. Representative Paul Gosar wrote a letter in town hall this week. Yes. Surprise. Surprise. I didn't get to that button quick enough. Surprise. Surprise, ladies and gentlemen.
Surprise. Surprise.
Why is Representative Paul Gosar skipping out on the Pope's visit to Congress? Media reports indicate His Holiness intends to focus the brunt of his speech on climate change, a climate that's been changing since first created in Genesis. We've all seen the movie. Was it the movie? Oh, that was the book. The climate was created in the book version, not the movie version. If the Pope stuck to standard Christian theology, I would be the first in line. If this Pope spoke out with moral authority against violent Islam, I would be there cheering him on. if the Pope urged the Western nations to rescue persecuted Christians in the Middle East, I would back him wholeheartedly. But when the Pope chooses to act and talk like a leftist politician, then he can be expect to be treated like one. I don't know much about Catholicism. It just seems to me that's a little bit uppity for the congressman to say that he knows more about Catholic theology than the Pope. But I don't know. I guess I have no problem with it when a Catholic says, I disagree with this Pope because he thinks that women shouldn't have autonomy over their own body. But that's why it is offensive to talk about climate change, because of those godless scientists who say that June through August of this year was the hottest summer in recorded weather history. It looks like this year is also, 2015 is in the running for the hottest year ever. But that's what the godless scientists say. Or even the scientists who are godly seem to say. So I will say this as an added feature. My daughter, my 10-year-old daughter, who does not know much about Catholicism, and in some ways I was almost embarrassed that she asked me this question, because I felt like I had not sufficiently educated her to some rather, I guess, major phenomena in the world. But Myla said to me the other day, she goes, hey, who's that guy who wears the yarmulke, that white yarmulke? He's in the news all the time. People are talking about him a lot. I'm like, the Pope? Yeah, it's not a yarmulke. And then I explained it to her. But it's sort of, it's not easy to explain to a 10-year-old kid like what the Pope is if they've grown up in a religion that does not have that type of central authority. But I did my best. Folks, today we received two songs from Jimmy Reefer Cake. We can't decide which one we're going to play in the free show and which one we're going to play in the members show. Matt, what are the two songs from Jimmy Reefer Cake? Because they both sound on point.
Yes, they do. One is called Presidential Primary Blues,
mm-hmm.
and one is just mysteriously called Fiorina.
Well, that's not that mysterious.
I think it's mysterious. Who knows what it could be about?
Who knows what it could be about? So, folks, vote on this. I don't know how many people will have vote. Go to @MajorityFM on Twitter. Matt will count up which ones. So one is the presidential primary, the primary blues, or Fiorina.
Yes.
And vote for one or the other, and as to what you want on the free show.
Yeah, members get both. So look at it this way. If you're a freebie, pick the one you want to hear. If you're a member, pick the one you don't want.
You want to screw over freebies. I like the attitude, Matt. That's really great. The first week of the football season is in the books, folks. Did you guys win money on FanDuel? Well, if not, you can this weekend. FanDuel is the trusted leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and payouts than any other site. They're paying out over $75 million a week this football season. Building a team is easy. Just pick your players, stay under the salary cap, sit back on Sunday, watch your team win. Entry fees start at just $1. Anyone can play. Last year, apparently, there was a guy from New York, Joe Watson, turned $50 deposit into over $30,000 in 2 weeks playing fantasy football on FanDuel. I would like to actually not just join him on FanDuel, I'd like to shadow him. There's over 1 million other users who have already won money. Go to FanDuel.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use my code MAJOR, as in majority. Sign up now. And this is a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. Offers only good for the first 50 people that use my code MAJOR today. Don't forget to use my code MAJOR. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Sign up today. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Cliff Schechter will be with us. We are back. Ladies and gentlemen, we are, it is Friday, and thus we are very excited to welcome to the program the same person that we are excited to welcome to the program on most Fridays when we have the luck to welcome him to the program. The man who is sung about in this song by Jimmy Rufkin.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Yes, Cliff Schechter, how are you, Cliff? Have you recovered from the 42-hour debate the other night?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, I used to say that my happiest time in the world, other than, of course, being with my family, was watching a Republican debate, because I just garnered so much enjoyment from that experience. But they killed it for me the other night. I mean, I'm sorry, you know, even this group of clowns can't be funny going on like 3 or 4 hours. I mean, I thought they were going to have to, like, resuscitate Trump at some point. And who'd want to do that mouth-to-mouth, by the way? You know, they were holding Chris Christie up with those things they used to hold up the Macy's Day Parade balloons. It looked like things were getting rough there.
All right, I want to go into this. We have some sound clips and whatnot. But before we do, let's talk a little bit about just two things that are happening in Congress, because so much of this stuff is implicated by what's happening in the debates, it seems to me. And not just the debates. I mean, really this primary. And I think, you know, in many respects, I'm not quite sure why I feel this way specifically, but I think part of it is because we're talking about We have a divided Congress, or I should say we have a Congress that has the opportunity to be divided in 2016. It's unlikely the Democrats could take the House. We're talking about a new president. And I think also because we have senators running for the presidency.
Rubio,
and he's leaving, but his votes in the Senate are still going to be relevant in the context of this election. So it's implicating a lot of stuff in terms of legislatively speaking. And in some respects, I regret that the TPP seems to be sort of stalled right now, because it would be interesting to see if a vote came up what Trump would do to the TPP. But let's just start with Iran. There was a last sort of a white-knuckled last-ditch effort by the Republicans to scuttle the Iran deal by proposing an amendment that basically said something to the effect, I mean, I didn't read it, but it was just clearly one of those, like, we stand with Israel against Iran, or something to the effect of that, you know, something that had nothing to do with the actual deal itself, but
right.
Republicans thought it would be difficult for Democrats to vote against. That actually, I think, got more votes against that amendment than the original vote to scuttle the Iran deal. I think it picked up one or two other people. It was such a lame attempt. But it's interesting, because you had both Trump and Ted Cruz have a rally to scuttle this Iran deal, and it didn't seem to have any impact.
No, none whatsoever. Which is pretty funny. And I mean, really not anything they've done, whether it's the in the end, you know, the $20 million spent by AIPAC, the additional $10 million spent by Norm Coleman's group, right? I mean, all this stuff, it just shows, you know, I never will say the playing field's being leveled, but there's a lot more you can do out there today than you can, even when you're up against big money, like in that situation. But in terms of Trump and Cruz, if anything, they seem to have pushed momentum in the opposite direction, which I find amusing. I'm not sure I can even think of much else to say about it. Clearly, they've done nothing.
And
it's been enjoyable to watch.
And what's also fascinating to me is that it's you've got now, you know, particularly after this last debate. I mean, Carly Fiorina has made her bones in that debate, it seems to me, largely from lying about what's in that Planned Parenthood video. Now, the fact that she lied about it aside, the idea is that they desperately want to push the idea of defunding Planned Parenthood. It got a lot. I mean, there was a lot of time spent on that during the debate. The House Republicans in particular are demanding a government shutdown over defunding Planned Parenthood. The House leadership called them into a room, I guess it was yesterday, and said, look, this is a bad idea. We're going to get blamed for it. But, you know, but the argument's very tough for them to make, because the last time they did this, they shut down the government in 2013 for, I don't know, I can't remember. It was like 10 days, 12 days. And then they came back and they did, you know, pretty well in 2014. So it's going to be now, I think they're going to take a much bigger beating in an on-year election than they did in an off-year election. And particularly one where everything else is frozen, right? I mean, in 2013, you move on to have other legislative fights. In this situation, it's just going to hang out there, I think. So,
yeah.
But it's fascinating to see them get pushed down this hole. And, just give me your sense on that, because there was another piece about how the Democrats are going to use Trump and now Bush, because Bush is having to follow Trump around a little bit policy-wise, to in this budget fight that's coming up in the next couple of weeks.
Right. I mean, like, they're overwhelmingly on the wrong side. I think the polling showed that the majority of Republicans are against him. It's like 75-something percent of people overall don't want the government shut down for this reason. I mean, again, you know, but they're playing, as we always talk about, to the craziest couple percent that would show up in, like, you know, a tsunami in Iowa to make sure they cast that caucus vote for, you know, whoever is going to make sure they're raptured forthwith. So, you know, that, and so their interests of that small, you know, group is against everybody else's. And so that's the beauty of all of this. You know, when you bring up what happened in 2013, I mean, the problem, that was a year, you know, a year ahead of time. And you may remember that some polls started showing that Democrats might win back the House because the Republicans were so unpopular. The big problem is that, as often happens with this stuff, Democrats didn't take that advantage and run with it. You know what I mean? And put on the brake, you know, on the gas instead of, you know, being cautious. I think that was part of the problem, is that they didn't run with it. And part of the problem, again, is, you know, which is difficult, because we never know what's going to happen, is with the media. Because, again, the media doesn't get, you know, overall, mainstream media does not give people context. They're still doing chocolate and vanilla. He's right, she's right, you know, each side is doing half of the things wrong. I don't know if you ever read stuff by Paul Rosenberg over at Salon, but he had a great piece on, you know, talking about some of the stuff that, if you remember, one of the reasons why they were able to do what they did, sure, the demographics of off-year elections, you know, of the midterms are always different, and that hurts Democrats. But also, you know, the media afterwards spent like 2 months on the whole, you know, Obamacare website, as if that was as big a deal as people willing to shut the government down. Because, you know, people, they felt like, oh, well, we beat up the Republicans for a while, now it's the Democrats' turn. And that's the biggest thing that still has not been solved, even though you have more mainstream media, I would say, today that are willing to call out who's wrong. I think it's the cultures of the media is heading in the right direction overall in that way. But it's, you still have the, and we all know who they are. Let's just call them the Ron Fournier crew. I don't even know how to pronounce this stupid name, but you know what I'm talking about. And you know, it's always about both sides being wrong. And if both sides are wrong, then they don't pay as big a price. It's amazing that people still do get it, even though the media is not doing their job, and somehow they do. So,
well, let me. There's two things I want to talk about, because a couple of the clips that we have, or at least one of them, is from the debate, is a question that that is sort of indicative of the media, the moderators, not just not correcting the BS that they heard, but actually serving it up, like not even perpetuating it, like almost introducing it on one level. Yeah. And we'll get to that.
And can I say something quickly too?
Of course.
I mean, you know, if they're going to have Hugh Hewitt there,
right,
then they need to be very clear that who Hugh Hewitt is, because they're allowing him to sit there and say crap. He didn't even pretend to be objective in the slightest. He's like, well, I know you all are right about Planned Parenthood. But,
good for him. I'm glad he didn't pretend, you know, because at least...
No, but then people should know he's not from CNN. And they announced that once. And, you know, and then it's, well, I hope you figure it out. And I think that it has to be much clearer that he is not from CNN. And then, fine, let him ask whatever he wants. I don't care, you know, but I just want that to be very clear to people.
I agree with you. And well, let's play. Do we have this clip? I want to start with this clip from the, let me just add this one more thing, that there is a piece out that during the course of this, budget fight, Democrats are going to push the Donald Trump and now Jeb Bush, proposals to close loopholes, close like the carried interest, I think it was that Trump said.
Yep.
And which is fantastic, because like Trump is working like double time, double duty on this. And the Democrats, we will play the clip today of Trump. Basically, you know, it doesn't matter really whether or not you say Trump encouraged this Muslim bashing guy at this rally or not. It's just, you know, when we play the audio, we can just sort of just do our own little thought experiment if we want. If Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders got a question about getting rid of all the Christians in the country, and they didn't respond. They just said, well, we're going to look into it.
Exactly.
We'll get to
we'll
that.
We'll investigate.
Matt, which one is here? Is this the Donald Trump vowing to donate his Social Security? Okay, is the one where... right before Chris Christie, but this is also the one where it starts with Dana Bash asking a question about Social Security. Now, this is like, you know, it's one thing. I mean, look, Jake Tapper did not correct any of the complete bullcrap that was spewed by the Republicans during that debate. Now, I don't feel terribly strongly. My expectations of him doing that are pretty limited, right? I mean, you know, because certainly, I mean, here's the dynamic with the Republican debate, it seems to me, that whenever they get into policy, like Carly Fiorina saying what we should do is, you know, we should put more troops in Germany and we should be moving people to the Baltics. I mean, everybody who has like looked at what she actually said there has said
we have to increase to like 50% our defense budget to do what she wants.
Well, and on top of the fact that to the extent that she called for us to do anything, those things have already been done. And, you know, except for increasing our presence in Germany from 40,000 troops to whatever it would be, 44,000 troops, as if that would make any type of difference. Now, one might expect that you would have other candidates go, hey, what you just said is a load of horse crap. That doesn't mean anything. But the fact is that during a Republican debate, particularly these debates, policy is irrelevant. And it's irrelevant to the voters. Donald Trump knows that. He's said it like explicitly in other venues. But they all know that. I mean, you know, they just espouse word salads so that there's a perception that they know what they're talking about. It's sort of like the Paul Ryan playbook. But here is Dana Bash espousing bullcrap. I mean, here you'll hear her question about Social Security. I know it'll drive you crazy. This is Dana Bash from CNN, basically offering up the fantasy that Social Security is going to go insolvent. What I just stated doesn't even mean anything. It's a non sequitur. But here she is saying it, and Trump
said
responding
once or twice that you are really rich. And you are by far the richest person on this stage. Chris Christie says billionaires like you and even people who make and earn far less should no longer get Social Security, or at least there should be limits based on the income. You think he's wrong? And if so, why?
Speaking for myself, I'm okay with it. I think there's a certain truth to it. I know people that, frankly, it has no impact on their life whatsoever. There are many people. I would almost say leave it up to them. But I would be willing to check it off and say I will not get Social Security.
What about
I do
not. Country as a policy.
As a policy, I would almost leave it up to the people. Don't forget, they pay in and they pay in, and maybe they do well, and maybe some people want it. But the fact is that there are people that truly don't need it, and there are many people that do need it very, very badly. And I would be willing to write mine off 100%, Dana.
So,
okay, so that wasn't the clip where she says the solvent, right,
Matt? Right.
Okay. All right. We'll get to that in a minute. But let's just talk about that idea. That idea is so stupid. I mean, yeah, if people don't want to take their Social Security, they don't have to take it. And you know, and I guess Trump is right about that. I mean, that's the case with anything, right? You don't have to take any deductions on your taxes.
No,
you don't have to do anything.
Sure.
If we wanted to save any money, the idea that if billionaires or even millionaires don't take their Social Security, that we'd save any significant amount of money is silly. If you really want to means test Social Security, there's an easy way to do that, and that is just increase their taxes. And in fact, you don't even have to means test it. You just extend the cap so that they don't have to not pay taxes on their money. That's the easiest way to means test, or even
you're
just,
right. Let people know that. I mean, because people, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but people forget often that you're only paying taxes into, you know, up to what, the first 117,000 or so at this point. And so let people. There's a great way that billionaires and millionaires can put a lot more money into it and pay their fair share. And we're not doing it right now. And there's she could have brought up for context how there were numerous proposals in the Senate to do just that.
Yeah. Now, here she goes on to now make a false claim about Social Security. Never mind not correct one. Let's hear what Dana Bash says.
So is a voluntary program a way to get the Social Security system solvent again like that?
No, it's not. But with Donald in it, it's a good start. That's really good. No, listen.
Pause it for 1 second. Before we let Chris Christie spew his nonsense that Pete Peterson is paying him for, the idea that Social Security is not solvent now or even ever is ludicrous. Will you please explain to people, Cliff, why calling Social Security insolvent means is like, I don't know, saying, hey, I'm going to measure you with this tape measure. You're 2 pounds tall.
I lost you on that last part. What'd you say? I'm sorry.
Well, I'm basically saying that you can't... The idea that Social Security is insolvent is silly because everyone would have to evaporate and not pay into the system and just show up when they're 65 for it to be insolvent.
No, that's right. Yeah, I'm sorry. For some reason, it got sort of hazy. I couldn't hear what you were saying. I don't know if that's the line or whatever. Well, exactly. And again, you know, people are paying money into this as they're going along. This is sort of another big pot of money. It reminds me completely of what has happened with charter schools, with education. There's a lot of guys who are sitting there licking their chops, and they're looking for big pots of money to invest. And if you can attack these things and turn them into things that are, you know, that are failing and can make an argument that has failed again and again and again, if we just privatize this, it'll go better. It never does, by the way. So that's what this is a part of. And, you know, there's numerous studies out there, I mean, that show that at the current trust fund where it is, in any case, there's no adjustments that need to be made at all for this thing to be fully paid out, pay out full benefits to, what, 2037 or something of that sort. And at that point, again, we have this very simple way of dealing with any kind of Social Security shortfall. It's called allowing more people's income to go to paying payroll taxes, because right now it's regressive. You're only nailing the people, up to sort of an upper middle class level, but, you know, the first 117,000 or so of income. So there's other proposals that said, you know, we would get rid of it from $250,000 up, and you'd keep in that part in the middle, it wouldn't be taxed. There's others that just say we get rid of the cap completely. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders had a proposal, Tom Harkin had a proposal. Again, these are things with easy answers, as most of our problems we have are. You just have people with ideology or an opportunity to get their hands on money that don't want to hear those answers, and that's what we're dealing with.
It's 2033, I think, the trust fund is solvent to, and then after that it's, I think, around 22%.
Like 75% of its benefits, which
right.
is what it would pay if we did nothing.
Nothing.
I heard that debated. I think it's between 2033. I've heard 2033.
Well, 2033, there's three measures that the trustees use. They use an A scenario, a B scenario, and a C scenario. And they use basically the middle scenario, which has been traditionally significantly more conservative than reality. So in other words, even their B scenario is more conservative.
Right.
And they say the trust funds there.
Using the term conservative in the old, more positive sense of that word.
Well, just that they're very.
I'm having fun with you.
And so the idea of Social Security being insolvent is stupid because it is funded primarily on a rolling basis anyways. It's basically pay as you go. We just happen to have a larger trust fund now because of a deal in the 80s anticipating the growth of the baby boomers. So this is an absurd question, and I was likening it to when my 2-year-old son whips out my tape measure and he wants to measure how tall I am. And I say, how tall am I? As he looks at the thing and he says, you're 2 pounds. It just doesn't make any sense to say solvent in terms of Social Security. So, all right, let's listen to another segment from the let's hear what Christy has to say about Social Security.
This is an issue that we've got to talk about, and we haven't talked about yet. 71% of all federal spending is on entitlements and debt service. When John Kennedy was elected president in 1960, it was 26%. Harvard and Dartmouth says that Social Security is going to go insolvent in 7 to 8 years. So what I say is very simple. We need to save this program for the good people out there who have paid into the system and need it. And if that means making sure that folks like Donald and many of us on this stage don't get it, that's the right thing to do, because here's what Hillary Clinton's going to want to do. She's going to want to put more money into a system that has already lied to us and stolen from us. This government doesn't need more money to be Social Security solvent. We need to be not paying out benefits to people who don't really need it. We need to protect the people whose Social Security means the difference between picking between heat and rent and food. That's why I put out the proposal, and that's the people
I'm
trying
to protect.
Thank you, Governor. All right, let's stop it there. Now, this is an incredibly cynical and craven approach to this. He is. We know that means testing on Social Security in this way would not save any significant money, and that the easiest way to do it is simply just to make them pay more taxes on the front end. Just raise their premiums on this insurance so they'll get their retirement insurance either way, which is absolutely fine if he's really concerned about those people who are making the choice between heat and food based on their Social Security.
And also, let's be clear that this guy who is so concerned about what the government spending and government debt and all the rest, Chris Christie, is somebody who, as a U.S. attorney, had the most unexplained expenses, where he would go, supposedly, you know, doing the government's work and stay at, like, you know, a $4,000 a night hotel, because that's Chris Christie, and we'd all have to end up paying for it. Out of all the U.S. attorneys in all of the states, he had the most unexplained. I mean, you know, so I get a little tired also when it's the hypocrisy, too. It's sort of like, yeah, you're not a good messenger for that, pal. You're really not.
Well, I still contend that he's getting his funding from Pete Peterson after Ken Langone, the billionaire from Home Depot, basically said, like, yeah, you know, he's a nice guy, but I'm not going to waste my money on a guy who's probably going to be sitting in federal penitentiary by the time this thing's over. Now, Langone didn't say the federal penitentiary line, but, you know, he's not.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if you're right. But with all these guys, I think that, you know, the question is, any given time, I mean, we're really at a different point in time, you know, than when our system began and as it has gone on through the centuries, and where people could have thought up the ways. And I mean, we know now, because we've seen cases where people have literally taken jobs right after they've left office or whatever, with a group that magically was they were advocating for their interests, but they weren't necessarily donating a ton to them then. You were like, I wonder what it's about. You know, these guys all have post-presidential careers. They all have both Senate careers. I mean, most of them, or if not all of them, will not be presidents. But if they were to become presidents, I don't think that the big corporate guys aren't smart enough to promise a lot of people a lot of things down the road.
Let's listen to another feature from the debate. I mean, I don't know if there's specific things that you want to talk about, but this was this exchange between Bush and Trump. I mean, you know, here's the thing about Jeb Bush, right? He's got a $100 million PAC behind him. And he is polling now in single digits. And I get that we are still months away, but there was not – I went back and looked at some of the polls from the 2012 election. And and Mitt Romney, who ended up being the nominee, was never in single digits. The last time he was in single digits was in May 6th of 2011, in only one poll. There in May, there was almost over a dozen polls taken, and he was only under 10% in one poll, the Zogby poll. That's in May of 2011. The rest in the month of May, 19%, 16%, 22%.
Didn't he always lead in New Hampshire, too? I'm pretty sure. I mean, it's hard to remember now, but I don't feel like he ever was in, I mean,
New Hampshire was special because he was from Boston, and so he had that. But then in June.
No, but August, Jeb has to, you know, be doing well in one of those early states. I know it was more of a home playing field for Mitt, although Jeb does have the family in Kennebunkport, which ain't that far from New Hampshire, but and the family's from Connecticut and the rest of it. Okay, so you could say that that's sort of stretching it. But the point is that in both of those first two states, he's being crushed right now, and that's the reality of the situation.
It just does not look like. I mean, if you even go back to 2010, the guy was in double digits. He was never in single digits. He was as much as the Republican base hated Mitt Romney. He was never this as sort of, it seemingly sort of universally hated as Jeb Bush. And there's just no place where you find where he gets his votes. I mean, you can add up like all the other non-Trump, non-Carson, non-Cruz voters. And even if every single one of those voters congeals around Jeb Bush, he still doesn't even reach, I think, like 45%. And this is, and here is why, it seems to me, because this goes directly to the idea that the Republicans don't care about at all about policy. It's because Donald Trump is just slapping this guy around, and Jeb Bush just looks anemic. And, you know...
I think that, you know, and if he were going to pick up, if we were saying, oh, well, these establishment votes would be going his way, right? You know, I mean, Scott Walker has literally cratered in the last month and a half or so, and Jeb hasn't picked up anything.
Nothing.
You know, I mean, if anything, he's lost something. So that vote that was, some of that theoretically had to be establishment people, went to Kasich, and, you know, for example, and went to other places. They clearly didn't go to him. You know, I mean, he's really a bad candidate. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that he's a terrible debater. You know, he is out there. He's been pegged, whether, you know, fair or not, and you could maybe say it's not fair, that his family name is at this point poison among the Republican base. There are some legitimate reasons for that, obviously, and there's some that are just because the base is crazy and consider them to be liberals, right? And so, I mean, he's up against it already. I mean, what I don't get is, and you just wonder how these guys ever learn how to play this game, you know, which is the point is, when they're sitting there hoarding all of this money, what is that for? I mean, the whole point is, if he doesn't make it to the third primary, it doesn't matter. Now, I don't see where he gets the votes either, no matter how much money he spends. But I still don't get why, when his numbers weren't going anywhere, these guys didn't start spending a lot of money in Iowa and in New Hampshire and in D.C. to at least, you know, to try to alter the kind of congealing conventional wisdom about him, to get sort of a lot of the opinion makers there and others to start saying more positive things. I mean, it can't hurt, right? You've got $100 million in a
two
in a
words.
Super PAC.
Two words for you. Eric Cantor. I mean, just as blind as Eric Cantor was to what was going on in his tiny little district, I just don't think that these Republican establishment have any idea of who the Republican Party is anymore. Here is Donald Trump. Here's George Bush. I mean, Jeb Bush demanding that Donald Trump apologize to his wife.
Stop being mean to my wife.
Here it is.
Governor Bush, Mr. Trump has suggested that your views on immigration are influenced by your Mexican-born wife.
Pause it for a second. We should also say that in Jeb Bush's own book, he attributes his views on immigration to his Mexican-born wife. So it's not, you know, I mean,
you can't really get all up in arms about
and
that.
And you know what?
Look,
I mean, that's the way that Republicans develop empathy. It has to affect them directly.
They need to know somebody from a specific, if they have a gay son, they're
exactly.
in favor of gay marriage.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
If somebody's got in a drunk driving accident, they want to reform those laws. It's exactly right. Republicans only can have empathy if something's actually happened directly to them and their family.
Right. And so here's the question.
He said that, quote, if my wife were from Mexico, I think I would have a soft spot for people from Mexico. Did Mr. Trump go too far in invoking your wife?
He did. You're proud of your family, just as I am.
Correct.
To subject my wife into the middle of a raucous political conversation was completely inappropriate. And I hope you apologize for that, Donald.
Well, I have to tell you, I hear phenomenal things. I hear your wife is a lovely woman.
She is.
I
she's
don't
fantastic.
Know her. And this
she
is a total
absolutely the love of my life, and she's right here. And why don't
Good.
You apologize
Good.
For her
No, I won't
right
do that
now.
Because I said nothing yeah. wrong, but I do hear so she's a lovely woman.
So here's the deal. My wife is a Mexican-American. She's an American by choice. She loves this country as much as anybody in this room. And she wants a secure border, but she wants to embrace the traditional American values that make us special and make us unique. We're at a crossroads right now. Are we going to take the Reagan approach, the hopeful, optimistic approach, the approach that says that you come to our country legally, you pursue your dreams with a vengeance, you create opportunities for all of us, or the Donald Trump approach? The approach that says that everything is bad, that everything is coming to an end. I'm
Jeb
on the Reagan side of this.
That they come into our country as an act of love. With all of the problems that we have in so many instances, we have wonderful people coming in. But with all of the problems, this is not an act of love. He's weak on immigration. By the way, in favor of Common Core, which is also a disaster. But weak on immigration, he doesn't get my vote.
There you go. And he's not just – and, you know, I think
– I got to say, can I hit something quickly?
Go.
I love how Trump talks about his wife like she's one of his business projects or mm-hmm. talks about Bush's wife. I've heard phenomenal things about her. Yeah, I'd buy. I'd go. She's going up in the polls.
Exactly. I mean, it's – he takes that and he basically says, like, I'd be happy to date your wife. I mean, he's basically saying, like, yeah, that's basically what he's saying. It's like, you know, look, I'm sure she's wonderful. And if she wants a real man, I mean, this is the thing. This is the dynamic that's playing out here. And Trump, I think, very shrewdly, and, you know, less, you know, people should remember that I think Trump is a despicable person, but he is really helping America here, it seems to me.
He is a despicable person, but I still have to admit I'm enjoying him.
Oh, yeah. No, he's
watching anybody so torture Scott Walker, Jeb Bush, you know, that I can't say that I dislike him for that. There's many things I dislike him for. He is a miserable person who should never get anywhere close to being president. And yet, he is performing a sort of service right now.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Because Jeb has these very distinct, besides the name and everything, these distinct weaknesses. Look, if you're a member of the Bush family, you better be the George W. member who's spitting tobacco on themselves and clearing brush and wearing your goofy hat and thinking that you're tough and being an evangelical or at least a fake one. I mean, that's, you know, being a sort of more of a mainline Protestant guy, you know, with glasses doesn't play in the Republican
Party. Well, it's
also,
I mean, look, the bottom line is, I mean, it would have been fascinating to see in this day and age. I mean, the Republican Party is basically, this is the project that they've been working on for 20 some odd years, and it's just gotten out of hand, and Donald Trump is just sort of fitting the bill. And I think he very shrewdly called Jeb Bush at the end of that thing, you're weak on this, you're weak on that. And he's basically just saying, you're weak. You're
right.
Weak. You just asked me
and
to apologize
to
your
wife.
Yes. But the Jeb Bush thing,
Sorry.
He goes after this guy with a vengeance. He hates Jeb Bush. And Jeb Bush just sat on national television, demanded that a guy apologize to his wife, and backed off it so quick. It was stunning. And, you know,
look, I'm, you know, you and I and probably other people listening to this, we're not like these sort of base, you know, atavistic males, you know, who are like, ugh, I kill food now, who basically make up the Republican, you know, the Republican base. And yet to me, like a guy standing there and saying and begging someone almost to apologize to their wife seems weak and pathetic. I mean, I can only imagine how it seems to them, you know. Right, I mean, they're probably ready to throw the guy off overboard.
Oh yeah,
you know? I mean, it's sad.
Well, but that's the thing. I mean, Jeb was specifically, look, Jeb didn't care about what Donald Trump saying that about his wife. He didn't say anything about his wife. All Jeb wanted to do was to prove that he could get Donald Trump to apologize, and he couldn't. And so it's basically like Jeb walked out there with some type of swagger, like, watch me bench press 75 pounds. And he couldn't even get it off his chest.
And
that was the
right.
problem.
That's what it came off as, like somebody who's trying to act tough in front of you, who you know is kind of a wimpy person, and they're faking it, and they're not even pulling it off. That's the way it came off to me. And again, I couldn't care less about any of those behavioral characteristics.
Right.
I don't even want them in a president. And yet, to me, it came off as wimpy. So to these guys on the
right,
who they live and breathe by how big their gun is, you know what I mean, and stuff like that, good luck on that one, Jeb.
There was one more exchange between the two of them, which was also fascinating, because my understanding is that national political reporters around the country, as soon as this exchange happened, got sent an issue paper showing that Donald Trump was lying about this. But Jeb mishandled this so poorly that it didn't resonate with anybody. And it was supposedly, you know, like, I've just nailed you, Donald Trump, in a lie where you tried to bribe people and it didn't work with me. And it just comes off again as Jeb being ineffectual.
Right.
Here's that segment right now where Jeb speaks about Donald Trump's attempting to open, I guess it was a casino in Florida.
One of the reasons Mr. Trump is a front runner, Republican voters say, is because they like the fact that he is not bought and paid for by wealthy donors. Mr. Trump has repeatedly said that the $100 million you've raised for your campaign makes you a puppet for your donors. Are you?
No, absolutely not.
No.
People are supporting me because I have a proven record of conservative leadership, where I cut taxes $19 billion over 8 years. We shrunk the state government workforce. We created a climate that led the nation in job growth 7 out of 8 years. We were one of 2 states to go to AAA bond rating. People know that we need principle-centered leadership, a disruptor to go to Washington, D.C. The one guy that had some special interest that I know of that tried to get me to change my views on something that was generous and gave me money was Donald Trump. He wanted casino gambling in Florida.
I didn't want it.
Yes, you did.
Totally false.
You wanted it, and you didn't get it.
I was
opposed to casino gambling
before, during, and after.
And that's not, I'm not going to be bought by anybody.
I promise, if I wanted it, I would have gotten it.
No way, man.
Believe me.
Nope.
I know my people.
Not even possible.
I know my people.
Is there anything else you want to say about this?
No, I just will tell you that, you know, Jeb made the statement. I'm not only referring to him. A lot of money was raised by a lot of different people that are standing up here. And the donors, the special interests, the lobbyists have very strong power over these people. I'm spending all of my money. I'm not getting any. I turned down. I turned down.
Okay, we don't need to hear any more. But so
it does have a Ross Perot-like appeal in a certain way to some people, that whole thing.
But, Jeb,
what is
going on with Jeb Bush here? I mean, that was clearly,
but the Jeb Bush part, yeah,
that was clearly a set piece that he had, that they were going in to do a gotcha here. And he doesn't say, well, Donald, you say that's not the case. On my website, Jeb!2016.com, or we actually went out and bought a special URL. DonaldTrumpsALiar.com. Go see the documents right there that prove what we have. There's a political malpractice here by Jeb that is just stunning. And this is the guy who's got $100 million.
Nothing. Somebody should make them read like a copy of Drew Weston's book. You'd think all Republicans instinctively know this, that especially with their base more than anywhere else in politics, this is all about identifiers, tribalism. You know, it's all about emotion. I mean, you can say, well, you gave money to Hillary Clinton, and you did this, and you were once pro-choice. They don't care about any of that stuff in the end. They're identifying with this guy who's beating up on people that they like him for beating up on. So for the Bush people, the only way you can go after Trump is to go after him on those types of things. Frankly, Carly Fiorina did the best job, because one of the few things that gets to him when you go after him is the bankruptcies. Where if you question his prowess as a businessman, frankly, if you want to do it, you question his manhood. I'm not saying in that exact way, but you go after him, on things like that, on his what he considers part of his identity. That is the only way you're going to get at Trump. To go at him with like policy papers and you flip flopped, it's not going to work. And they don't. I mean, you're right. It's malpractice, and they just don't. It's like you just don't think, have any of you ever done this before? I mean, it's amazing to me.
This is the A team. This is their deep bench. And Jeb Bush comes back with, he kept us safe with a picture of George Bush standing on the rubble of the World Trade Centers. He kept us safe. It's as if the world started on September 12th for these people. You get one mulligan.
Exactly. Everybody has that one terrorist attack where 3,000 people die. After that, he protected us completely. It's like a scene from The Life of Brian, right? But then you're like, well, what about the anthrax? Okay, besides 9/11 and the anthrax, he protected. What about the shoe bomber? Okay, besides 9/11, the anthrax, and the shoe bomber, what about credit default swaps? Besides 9/11, the anthrax, credit default swaps, what about Katrina? I mean, you could just go on with the many times that George W. Bush did not protect us from anything. And, but that's all down the memory hole. It's all about 9/11. And then 9/11 gets forgotten. I mean, it's just an amazing statement that he can say he protected us. He didn't protect how many thousands of people who've died in Iraq, or our troops who were sent over there who didn't have to go. Not so much protection for them either. I mean, and frankly, if we played this game, we could go on for an hour.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning. All right, Cliff, I wish we had more time. I got more stuff to talk to you about. But alas, our time is fleeting. I appreciate you coming on today. We will talk again next week. And the next debate that we're going to see is, if I'm not mistaken, is going to be the Democratic one in about 3.5 weeks. And I may be in attendance in Las Vegas. Yeah, I'm working on that right now.
Oh, my gosh, that would be awesome.
Well, that's when, sometimes you join us down there at the trial lawyer conference that I go to.
Where's the next one going to be?
The next debate is, it turns out, going to be in Vegas. And push up my ticket a night or two and head down there.
I may have to join you.
It would be fun.
That would be fun.
Indeed.
All
right.
Before, I know you're going to kick me off, and you have every right to, but I would just want to encourage the fine folks listening to this show to look up John Kasich and MAID in Google.
Right.
Because they just asked John Kasich, how is he going to win over Hispanic voters? And he talked about how he likes to tip his maids at hotels. So that may be one you guys want to look up and just watch the next 48 hours of John Kasich's life become a lot of fun.
I got to say, I was right on Donald Trump. I think I overestimated John Kasich. But although I still think that, they've got to settle on somebody. And I don't think it's going to be Carly Fiorina.
Kasich has the advantage of who he's up against.
Yeah, who's left? Because I actually think that at the end of this, we're going to see Ted Cruz emerge. And it is, I had this feeling in 2012 that it was possible nobody would win the Republican primary. And it's even, you even get that sense even more so now. It's very strange what has happened in this party. And I think Ted Cruz could just as easily, I can make a rational guess that Ted Cruz could be the nominee as much as I could anybody.
I think there's an amazing case to be made there that he could be the nominee because he could get the Trump and Ben Carson vote go to him.
Yep.
And he's enough of an insider, having been Solicitor General in Texas, having worked on George Bush Sr.'s campaign way back when, I believe. He was appointed by George W. Bush in Texas. And he's run against the establishment. He ran against their pick there. But he's enough connections. He knows them well enough. He has the right pedigree from his Ivy League schools and the rest that if he were willing to go behind closed doors and promise them he wouldn't do certain things, I could see him getting the Trump vote, and then I could see the establishment begrudgingly getting behind him.
Because who else is going to emerge? Like Scott Walker, it seems to be going nowhere. Jeb Bush, it's just so hard to see him come out of this morass. And it's Kasich, I guess, to a certain extent, is hanging around. But the idea that Marco Rubio,
you don't see Bobby Jindal running the way.
No, the idea that Marco Rubio is going to win the nomination for president in this Republican Party is absurd. I don't care. I mean, Rubio could get out there and do the full Bobby Jindal. In terms of like, I'm not Muslim or what but the fact is Marco Rubio is in a party that is the bedrock of the party is just this hostility towards people who are not white.
The big mistake he made was not changing his name to Marco Smith.
Indeed.
He had a much better shot.
Indeed. Cliff Schechter, always a pleasure.
All right. My pleasure. Take care, buddy.
Bye-bye. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be talking to Matthew Film Guy. Oh, we're running late today. All right, we'll be right back after this. Folks, that sleepy interlude was brought to you by JustCoffee.coop. I just wanted to work it in, but I felt a lot more energy than that musical interlude. Seriously, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It is, everybody gets a fair wage in the entire process. It's a co-op. They have the Majority Report blend, which I know for a fact a cafe in Hudson, New York, serves as their house coffee. So you can get the Majority Report blend and you get 10% off. It's fantastic coffee. They send it right to your door, free shipping. You'll love it. Folks, you know who's up next on this program? Here's a little hint.
Choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and Amazon.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Matthew, film guy, welcome to the program. Matthew, how are you?
Hey, Sam, I'm great. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to be here. I am currently hopped up on Majority Report blend coffee that I'm drinking from my legacy Majority Report radio mug while wearing my Majority Report radio hat and using my Majority Report mouse pad.
Wow, you really are old school. There's one remaining hat. I'm looking at it right now. It is a white Majority Report trucker hat. It's the last one, I thought, in existence. And there is, I think, one mouse pad in this office. People don't even have mouses or pads or any of it anymore.
I have a couple that I'm selling on eBay, but never mind that. I think you should save that last hat for the Smithsonian, Sam.
Oh, yes, indeed. It's going into the time capsule with all of the episodes of this program. Matthew, what is the latest on your end? What are you doing these days? Why? Why are you doing it?
Why? That's a multifaceted question, Sam. Why is anybody doing anything, really, when it comes down to it? Because we were born on this planet. We're given a certain amount of years to do what we will do, and then we do it. And that's all I can really offer you in terms of concrete reasons. But I can tell you that a lot of what I do is motivated by money.
Well, I'm glad you have such clarity in your life these days, Matthew. Is that what you make when you do that learning annex class at the JCC in on the North Shore of Long Island?
Well, while I am marginally compensated for that, no, you have picked on one of the few things that I do just for the love of it, just for the love of talking film, as I do here every so often, and which I am not compensated for, just to remind the audience. But it is definitely not one of the things I'm doing primarily for cash. You know, lately, a lot of the work that I've been getting has been as the comedic video maker for corporate interests, which is highly, highly confusing for me, because on the one hand, it is sucking Satan's pecker, as Bill Hicks might say, but on the other hand, it is getting to actually be somewhat humorous and funny with video and filmmaking for actual cash. So they keep hiring me as like the funny video guy.
Really?
And it's always these sort of semi-corny videos. Like I had to do a parody of the Shark Tank show, you know, featuring corporate officers from this company and make it sort of look like them. And I got to do some funny stuff in that. And
oh, my God. So wait a second. So you're doing these industrials for them are supposed to be funny. Now, I got to tell you that over the years, I did live industrials back in the day when we were doing the Comedy Lab up in Cambridge. It was 20 some odd years ago. 25 years ago. And I acted in some corporate videos. It really is one of the most disturbing things you could possibly get engaged in some
respect. It really is, because you're sort of curtailed by what their idea of funny is, and they do look at you as sort of the expert on it, but they come to you with these scripts that have a lot of internal jokes. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right, Bob and R&D. Like, those R&D guys, they never clean their coffee pots.
Yeah, exactly. Or even just like even more esoteric things, like things that they always say to certain customers, and they're referencing things. And so I have to have them explain to me sometimes some of the jokes. But
like, what are the products? You don't have to give a brand name, but like, what are the products?
Well, a lot of these are corporate training videos that a large corporation that I work for, I can tell you, it's the hotel company that I work for. They often have these huge offsites that are in a big city somewhere, and they show these videos as sort of ostensibly semi-training, semi-sort of introductory videos. So it's all about the process, how you greet a guest at the front desk, certain programs that they're implementing in the rooms, things like this. But they write a script, and I'm meant to sort of edit it into something that's less dry and ultimately I just
so what's that joke that the clients come in when they come into the desk? Like, do they come in like, is it possible you have two king beds?
No, you know, one of the things is they always are asking. I had to have this explained to me. They're always asking, when will you be leaving? Like, it's important to the people behind the desk to know their checkout date, but it annoys people because they just got there and they're already talking about when they check out. So apparently this was a funny thing. Like, when are you leaving? And the woman goes, I just got here, and wah, wah, you know, so there's like that kind of thing that doesn't immediately strike you or I or anyone else who doesn't know it as funny, but they're big on that stuff. But I get to put in things like video special effects. I got to light a woman on fire through lightning. I got to flood a woman. I got to make a lot of toilet humor jokes. They go big for the toilet
sounds
humor
like
jokes.
I mean, it sounds like it's just sort of you're playing out some weird sort of misogynist fantasies when you the way you talk about it. You're lighting people, a woman on fire, you said specifically.
Well, I could do it to a man, too. It just so happened that this particular person was a woman. So, no, it's not. Maybe the glee in my voice gives me away somewhat, but no, this was all curtailed for me, who it was I'd be drowning or lighting on fire. And so it's just a person.
I hope. All I remember is that John Benjamin and I, a guy named Rich Gustis, Mike Lee, and I don't know if Laura Silverman was part of it when we
I remember down. Mike Lee. He was my scene partner in pilot season.
Yes, a very funny guy, very bizarre. I'm trying to think who was oh, and David Waterman, of course, who you do know. We got hired to do a, I think it was a, like a Wang function or something like that, like a retreat, a corporate retreat down the Cape. We drove down there. We did some of our own material. We did like one thing that was sort of catered to them, but we did basically our own material and we literally had to run out of the building. And I just, we heard, and Benjamin and I will still say this, we heard one guy with a very thick Massachusetts accent say to another guy with a very thick accent going, he said, that was fucking bizarre. And the other guy said, fucking bizarre is not the word.
Well, I see, I'm sort of caught in the middle here because the guys that I normally work for who do all the really slick videos for them that are often, you know, six-figure deals that are very, like, the branded videos.
Wait, are they paying you six figures to do those videos?
Not the comedy videos. Those are a little bit lower. But I'm telling you, did I mention I do these for the money? Anyway, so there's the higher-end videos that the guys that I normally work for who are very serious about. They're very slick commercial sort of products. They hate doing these comedy videos. So I've sort of carved out a niche as the guy who's willing to do them and also, for one reason or another, keeps getting referred to as a genius for doing these, what you and I would consider pretty rudimentary comedic sort of hack videos. But I've carved out a niche and it's paying the bills, so I can't really complain.
Do you need help?
I'll let you know if a position opens up, absolutely.
All
but,
right.
For now, I'm covering it between me and Mary and the small production
all right.
that I
well,
have.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, if you start getting a lot of work and you need to outsource some of that high five-figure, low six-figure work for these videos,
sure.
Because, you know, I also did murder mystery theater, and that's all the same, basically same stuff. Like, hello, you're a fat one, aren't you? And you move on to the next table, and the whole table laughs because you just made fun of the guy for being, you know, fat or something like that. And that's
okay. All right, you're doing well in your interview here. Right. This is working out. I think this could work out.
Okay.
But some of them I don't shoot. Some of them I just edit. Some of them I produce and shoot and edit. So you know, I have varying degrees of control over this. But I'll keep your name on the list.
Uh-oh, it's Bob from R&D. Everybody, hide your wraps.
Exactly. But you know, it keeps me able to enjoy the finer things in life. Keeps me living in New York City, which has always been the goal, is to live here and to be able to enjoy the great multifaceted works of art and film that are available here.
Janet,
and right now, it's like a
you're late again. We're gonna have to send you to accounting.
It's ask me how it is getting the invoice is filled. That's another whole story. But that's okay. They always come through. They do always come through.
90-day turnaround or 60-day turnaround on those?
Oh, 90 at least.
Of course, right? 180. Yeah. Well, we're working on it. We've just got to get it cleared through. So, Matthew Film Guy.
Yes, Sam Peter.
You must be very excited. Apple TV has come out. They're expanding its offerings. Now just about every... I don't know. I mean, depending on what device you have, you can watch just about any movie or show or whatnot on your TVs now. And blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So
Sam, I've been there. I've been there for at least a year or two.
I understand. But I just was trying to peg it. I was trying to peg it to some type of news thing to make the segue.
Yeah,
Matthew, Film Guy. What do you have for us this week? I understand that you've actually employed the use of audio sound.
Yeah, I came across just the opening like 50 seconds of this movie that I want to tell you is actually, I only recently saw it finally for the first time, but it has played a huge role in my life as wanting to come to New York as I was also trying to segue. And it had it had been a legend amongst. See, I didn't have older brothers, and I guess you didn't either.
No, I did not.
And so I didn't get, like, you know, shown music and things like that. I had an older uncle who was very instrumental, but I also had camp counselors. I went to summer camp, Jewish summer camp, and all the older counselors were really instrumental in turning me on to things like music and movies and, you know, even like independent comic books and things like that. So this film was passed around a lot at this summer camp, and I had always...
So it's an older film. It's an older film.
Yeah, it's a classic of the 80s, and the stories of it, the stories of the New York life that it portrays was, I have to say, extremely instrumental in my wanting to come to New York. It is called Mondo New York, and it was sort of a low-budget documentary made in the mid to late 80s. It came out, I think, like 87, and it basically is a loosely sort of strung-together series of scenes that document various subcultures and underground groups and art groups and just all kinds of weirdness that goes on or went on in New York in the mid to late 80s. So it includes things like everything from Karen Finley, who you may remember as being one of the NEA4 in the early 90s.
Yep.
She was a performance artist. Her doing one of her most incredibly, I'd say, prescient one-woman shows, which I will come back to in a second. But also, do you know a comedian named Charlie Barnett? You ever heard of him? He was basically a street comedian. He went on to do things like Def Comedy Jam. He died early, but he was a guy who would just do stand-up in Washington Square Park, and the film features like a whole 15-minute set of his just keeping the people in the fountain raptured.
I think I remember seeing him, actually, then. When was this, the early 80s or late 80s?
I'd say mid. I'd say mid. Like, you know, maybe early to mid, but, you know, he unfortunately died of AIDS. He was a heroin user in the 90s, but he was a guy that, like, Dave Chappelle had said, like, one of his big mentors. So you get some sort of verite footage of him doing his act. And the act itself is a little, I don't want to say hack, but because at the time it was probably pretty...
You know, my experience with a lot of comedy is it just doesn't stand up over time. It really doesn't.
But it's fascinating from a cultural standpoint because he's doing comedy that's like become sort of standard, but you're watching him sort of blaze the trail there. You know, he's doing literally keeping people enraptured by, this is how white people walk to work. This is how black people walk to work. You know, like just really rudimentary kind of stuff, but it's fascinating to see it in its natural element. But the movie goes on. It has a performance artist like Joe Coleman. I don't know if you ever remember him, but he's a guy that you would love if you don't know his stuff. He was a super prankster. He used to, like, go into places and, like, have a vest full of firecrackers and, like, would light himself on fire and blow them up.
That does sound funny. So this is Mondo, New York. What is the sound, the audio that we're going to hear now?
Okay, so the opening is the opening 90 seconds or 50 seconds of a monologue by Lydia Lunch, who's another New York underground filmmaker and performance artist. I don't know if you know her stuff at all, but this is just a great intro to it. It's very 80s, but if you want to play it, I'll pause.
Okay, pause and let's play it right now.
I don't want to play.
Mondo, New York, home to outcast, misfit, reject, loser, pervert, lunatics, gangsters, pranksters, and outlaws. Yeah, neurotic, psychotic, maniacs, brainiacs, hippies, yippies, yuppie, junkies, flunkies, monkeys. Yeah, all trying to claw their way to the top of the trash, the top of the garbage pile. All screaming in the American obscene, me, 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 me. I want my fame, my fortune, my lousy 15 minutes, my what the fuck ever it is you want it, we got it. If you don't see it, ask for it, because it comes in all shapes and sizes, all colors and every dimension. Mondo, New York.
Wow, there you have it. That actually sounds great.
Yeah, it's awesome, and I want to just talk to you for another 5 seconds, if I can, about the Lydia, about the Karen Finley bit, because this film is basically extremely prescient in that it's, I mean, maybe it's always been this way, but Karen Finley's monologue that she's doing is ranting about all the bankers moving into her Lower East Side neighborhood looking to put up condos, and sort of railing against this sort of yuppie infusion of money. And it's like it could be written today and still be just as relevant and just as, I mean, if anything, it's sort of sad that this sort of fight has been going on for 30 years and basically it has been lost by the
oh, artist. Yeah, that fight is over. That is done.
So you're seeing the sort of initial embers of it sort of starting to be lit there, and I found that extremely shocking to watch after, you know, hearing about this movie for 20 or 30 years. But it also features things like voodoo groups doing actual, like, sacrifices and, like, you know, illegal cockfighting, things that I think have gone away. But so it's this really amazing picture of the sort of freaks and weirdness that New York had become known for, and by now is confined to, I don't know, Twitter accounts or Instagram accounts.
Yeah, it is a shame. But, and I got to say, you know, it's what's interesting to me is there was also a time, like in the 70s and the 80s, where Mondo, for whatever reason, there was a lot of films in the Mondo. Like I thought you were going to say,
right.
You know, Michael O'Donohue's. I can't remember what it was. Mondo something. I can't remember what it was.
Well, there's Mondo Cane. That was like sort of the big one, but it's the Italian word for world.
Well,
right?
Yes. So, I mean, I understand, but I'm saying there was a lot of popularity for like naming films. Mondo.
That's right.
Michael O'Donohue's. I can't remember what it was, but I just remember Mondo. And there was, I think there was a movie Mondo Hollywood too at that time. And
yep. Yep. And Mondo New York is one of the sort of cornerstones of it. Mondo Cane, Mondo.
Available on Amazon Instant Video.
Yep, and on Twitter and on YouTube to rent as well.
Oh,
so
all right.
It's out there after being sort of ungettable for quite a while.
Ungettable.
I mean, to most people.
Well, I'm very excited to see it. The director, Harvey Keith.
He went on to do almost nothing else, but for this alone, he should be remembered.
Jezebel's Kiss in 1990, he did, and Stand-ins in 1997, in Humanities, if I remember correctly.
How did you know all that? That's incredible. You have an encyclopedic mind.
Well, in some respects. I mean, he also was a writer for Perilous. And
Sam's been following this guy for...
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding? He's 5'8", if I remember correctly.
Right.
Which I believe is at 1.73 meters.
Wow.
I don't know. I'm just doing
I can't tell you anything, Sam. I can't tell you anything. You know, before we move on, I want to just make sure that I mention one thing that Matt brought up last time we were together, and that is the TV show Mr. Robot. Do we have a second?
We have 1 second, but I haven't watched any of it yet, so I don't want it to be ruined.
But I
want to
hear what Matthew's got to say.
All right. All I can say is, Sam, there's a gimmick in it that I do not buy that completely lost me.
Ooh.
And it sort of retroactively doused my enthusiasm for the show.
What's the gimmick?
Well, no, he's not going to say because I don't want to ruin it. That's why I said don't bring it up.
Yeah,
you're going to have to wait until next month when I watch. Now I don't know if I'm going to watch. I'll tell you something. Matthew Film Guy, Matt doesn't – he did – He's just
Matthew,
gimmicks.
He's
all about gimmicks.
You're the first
all.
Person I've ever heard say something negative about that show.
Yeah, well, that's why I wanted to.
Now
be
you know why he did it. Now why he had to squeeze it out.
I mean, Matt, do you like Fight Club too? That's why I hate that movie as well. So,
but it's not. No, he did not give it away because it's not the same at all.
Wow! All right, boom! You just got slapped. You just got bushed.
I wanted to love the
Jeb
show.
Bushed.
I thought it was so great up until that moment.
No, there's twists and turns, and then there's twists and turns on top of that twist and turn.
This is where Matt now says to Matthew Film Guy, you should apologize to Mr. Robot. He says it a couple of times, and then it doesn't happen, and he just moves on.
Look, I've met Mr. Robot. He's a wonderful person, I hear. I haven't met him, but I hear he's a wonderful person.
Listen,
but,
Mr. Robot
I didn't
has...
say anything wrong, so I'm not going to apologize.
Well, Matthew Film Guy... Always a pleasure.
Same here, Sam.
I'm going to watch that movie. I don't know when I'll get to it, but I'm going to try.
Okay, good luck to you on that.
All right. Talk to you later.
Have fun, Sam. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow. Not very optimistic of you watching that movie.
You know, it's just it's the beginning of the school year, and the kids become a little bit more, you know, they're not scheduled quite yet, and they're a little bit...
Well, it sounds like somebody needs a... quote-unquote tech day where he sits at home while the kids are at school and watches Mondo New York.
That's exactly, yes. I think people would understand if I needed to take some time off to study Mondo New York. All right. Do we have the results of our Jimmy Reefer Cake I guess, vote runoff to see which song we're going to play.
We do, and it was very close. But Freebies will be getting Presidential Primary Blues, and members will be also getting Fiorina.
Okay, so let's hear the Presidential Primary Blues.
Looking at the latest polls, hoping that Donald Trump will fall. If it wasn't for that arrogant a-hole, maybe they'd be talking about Rand Paul. Talking about the overgrown and overreaching military, the war on drugs, the prisons, the police state, and the NSA. Meanwhile, when you look at the Democratic race, Hillary can't be trusted. She's busted with the email disgrace. I choose Bernie Sanders because I like what the man is saying. But it's Trump insults, not Bernie quotes, that the media keeps playing. Oh, it seems like the candidates I like are always bound to lose. I got me a case of the presidential primary blues. Why does this have to go on for years? Sooner or later I'll end up in tears. I got me a case of the presidential primary blues.
Yes.
A song you'll be able to play for months and months to come.
Months and months to come. And then also years probably. We could theoretically play that every primary.
True.
We'd have to eliminate the specific names. But I understand Jimmy's lament. I have to say that Trump's presence in the race makes me just much more optimistic. I mean, frankly, and this is a bit of a bank shot, but I really do think that actually, in many respects, Trump, the presence of Trump in this race helps Bernie Sanders.
I agree.
Because if Jeb Bush was walking away with this right now in the Republican side, or even up like 20-25%, there would be just a sort of a conventional wisdom mindset that would have locked everything in. And, I think that, you know, we're going to see more attention on Bernie Sanders coming into the debate. It's also, in many ways, it makes people sort of focus on that debate more than they would have otherwise, I think. But we'll see. We'll see.
When you have like an outsider like Trump doing so well on one party, it forces the media to sort of be like, you know, maybe we should be looking at the more unconventional candidate on the other side.
I think there's something to that, but I think it works in slightly in a slightly different way. And I also think that I don't know if it's necessarily true, but I definitely think it's an easier argument to be made if you have someone like Trump. That you put up someone like Bernie Sanders, who in many respects is, I think, would be incredibly formidable against. Well, I think any Democrat's going to do well against Donald Trump or really any of those Republicans. They're all pretty weak. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. We're going to do a shorter fun half today because I got some meetings. I got many things, meetings and meetings, but I always like to give you guys extra time, and that's what we did today.
Sam's got to go watch Mondo New York.
I got to go watch Mondo New York, take a nap. All right, folks, don't forget, it's your support that keeps this show going. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Give us a rating on iTunes. Just head over to iTunes at majority.fm/review. And just get, you don't even have to give us a review. Just give us a rating. It really helps with the rankings. And even if you're a member, subscribe in iTunes. Just, and even if you haven't downloaded from iTunes, just go download one from iTunes, the free show, just to push us up the rankings. I know I get too emotionally involved in the rankings, but it helps. Remember, next week, I believe it is, we're going to be launching our first new podcast. It has nothing to do with me other than the fact that I'm executive producing it. My friend Brian Rich is going to talk sports with our buddy Grant, who was here the other night, and sports in terms of how it intersects with other aspects of our society. Interesting stuff. And I'm going to need your support to launch this. Ultimately, the idea is that this is the way that we're going to support this endeavor, is by having shows that are a little bit more commercially, you know, don't have the same ceiling. We're never going to do better than, let's say, what MSNBC does in terms of numbers. But sports shows can. Other types of shows can. So, more information on that later. 646-257-3920. Call in. You know the stuff on the IMs, because I already have 5,000 IMs. All right, we'll be right back after this.